Well, welcome to Bioluminescence. Today is a very exciting day. I've got my dear friend Chris Carota here, my hero, my mentor, the reason a bunch of us knuckleheads got into this business in the first place.
Oh, thanks for saying that. we do what we can. You know what I mean? It's been a long time, so I've been doing this a while, and you know, to have some knuckleheads who have become some of my closest friends in the world around me it's awesome. It's been great. It's been a great ride. So
yeah,
I appreciate all you guys and all the people who are listening, and you know, I'm sure most of the people listening are buddies of ours in some way or another. So it's super cool.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, which I can't imagine there are many. Chris is the very longtime lighting director for Phish. He's also spent time doing lots of other things, especially in the last like 10 years or so. And before we get to all of that, I want to start by taking a little trip down memory lane. I know like a month ago or so, one of the live streams was like your fourth show, I believe, that show in Massachusetts.
It was number 12.
Okay.
And it was I watched those Dinner in the Movies sporadically, but I really watched that one just because of the nostalgia of it all. And I was just sort of going back through history myself and realizing that I'm approaching show 1800. And I'm close.
Yeah.
And to watch show number 12 was, you know, it was just a super cool experience for
sure.
Me. It was so long ago, and it was the beginning. And back in those days, none of us had any idea where we were going to be today. It was just, we were just having fun. They were a bar band, and you know, there you go.
So
here we are today.
So that's kind of what I wanted to like explore a little bit with you first off. So, you know, it's pretty, heralded how you got to be working with Phish. You know, the story's been told a million times. Like I sucks, like I takes a leak, you step in, do a good job, Trey's happy, you pull him aside and be like, hey, that was me.
I wouldn't say like I sucks, like I just walked away at the wrong time and I jumped in at the right time. Old light guy is a good guy, you know what I
sure.
mean. It just circumstances that were out of my control. But yeah, that's basically the story. Yes.
So what I want to talk about, and something I don't know if anybody's ever really asked you, is what was the next 12 months like, basically? Because you had zero experience going into it, correct?
I did. Sacrifices were made. I won't lie to you. So that day that you're talking about, Phish was basically weekend warrior bars. You know, everybody had jobs or was in college or this, that. And I was in college. And the following weekend, there were a show in like New Hampshire and a show somewhere else, Vermont. We didn't really go very far yet. And Trey called me up, guitar player Trey called me up on that Thursday and said, hey, by the way, the other guy can't make it because there's a long story, but Trey, when I jumped in that moment, I guess for that 5 minutes, Trey really liked what I was doing with the four park ends that we had. He called me up that Thursday and said, hey, the other guy can't make it. You're going to do the lighting this weekend. And I went, I don't know anything about lighting. I don't even know how to set it up. Like, and he told me, he's like, we'll figure it out together, bro. And yeah, we went there and figured it out and plugged it all in. And all of a sudden, I was the lighting guy, roadie, van driver, lighting guy. Myself and Paul Languedoc, and I think that was it back then. So we all did everything, unloading yep. vans, loading vans. You know, there were two guys. So that was happening for a couple of 3 weeks. And then they decided that they were going to do their Colorado run.
Yeah.
They had already done the famous Colorado run with the photo of them carrying the piano across the street. This was Colorado run number 2.
So this is 89, right?
This is 89. I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was a senior in college. And if I went on this trip, I was going to miss like 2 months of college, maybe 3 months of college. And I had to make a decision. And, you know, let's just say I got in a lot of trouble with my parents for the decision I made, and basically was disowned for a while. And I'm not even kidding. I was not welcome back in the house, not home for Christmas, any of that, because I blew off my senior year of college, got in a van and drove to Colorado with a bar band from Vermont, you know, where at the time getting the advice that I was throwing my life in the garbage can, because really you're going to go follow a band, you know, like how many bands make it in this world? One out of every 10,000, you know? Yeah. So, but I just knew, you know, I'd been around them long enough and I'd been listening to music long enough. And my gut just told me that this was not going to be some flash in the pan thing. So I rolled the dice and got in the van and blew off my college career at the time. And those kind of sacrifices, I had a job, you know, like a part-time job, quit my job, you know, just had, you know, put all my eggs in one basket. That's what it was like back
then. It's so crazy because, I mean, I didn't actually know that much about that. And I share almost an identical experience to you. I dropped out of college, went and started doing lights for my friend's band. Now, they didn't become successful, but it at the very least laid the groundwork for me to find somebody who would become successful in Pretty Lights.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's a different path, but you found what you like to do and you pursued it beyond your first venture. And
yeah.
So it is a similar story in that way. Or I would be honest with you in saying that if my fish adventure didn't work out, I probably would have just gone back to college, finished my college career and what I was majoring in. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, it's unpredictable, but
absolutely.
It sounds to me like you found your passion and decided to explore it further.
So. Yeah. I mean, I was certainly committed because I too dropped out of school. I cut loose a little earlier than you. I only made it through my freshman year, so I wasn't as invested in college as you were. But needless to say, parents very unhappy with the decision. Disowned, but definitely on the shit list, I guess.
I basically did not see my parents for about 5 years, and then we played a show somewhere in middle New Jersey in some field in like 93, you know, some little, but they came. And by that point we had automated lights. We were going somewhere.
You were bigger.
And they begrudgingly came just to check it out. And they watched that show and saw what I was doing. And they somehow that moment in life gave them a change of heart. And they finally, with seeing with their own eyes, these are traditional old parents who believe in traditional values, but they saw it and said, wait a minute, that our son's actually doing something that's
A tricky thing because, you know, it's hard to understand what this all can be. You know, on the surface of it, you just think, oh, it's just like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Like you're just going off to the circus and, you know.
Yeah,
and being an asshole or whatever. But then
it's a slippery slope. I mean, I know you've dealt with this. How many people have come up to you in your life and said, hey, what do I need to do what you do? And it's a slippery slope because you want to kind of tell them what you did and what, you know, go find a band. But you're kind of giving them also the same advice of saying, you might be throwing your life in the garbage can.
Exactly. I get in trouble for this sometimes because the first bit of advice that I give most young people is like, prepare for your life to be really hard and really shitty for like at least 5 or 6 years if you really care about this, because those when you're learning and like, whether you're with a band or at a venue, if you're young and green, you are going to get shit on constantly. And
yeah, absolutely.
And you have to be able to endure
everybody,
it.
Everybody thinks it's glory.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to do what you guys do because, oh, it's got to be such huge glory to work for a band and be backstage and go to the parties. And it's none of that.
Yeah, exactly.
To try to like verbalize that to people and say, you don't, they don't listen because they have this dream in their head of what it's like to work in the music industry, that it's, that you're, that they think they're going to be part of the band somehow.
Yep.
Or I don't know what, but yeah, it's a hard lesson. Like you said, if you actually go for it, it is not an easy road. I mean, I can tell you my first 10 years were brutal and grueling. And not only was I the lighting designer, like I said, I was loading and unloading trucks, doing full on overnight drives. There was a month in 90 where we went across the country and did 29 shows in 31 days.
Yeehaw.
So you go, you know, 2 days off and you're just when you think you're going to die, you get to sleep. But, you know, it was literally get to drive all night, get to the show, unload the truck, set it all up, do the show, pack it all back into the truck, get in the truck, drive the truck another overnight to some other city, get there just in time to load in over and over and over and over again with no sleep.
Yep.
You sleep on a road case for 45 minutes before like sound check and that's it. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so
I will say that like, I think the industry has changed to some regard as far as that aspect goes nowadays.
Yeah, I like don't Full Sail and all that kind of stuff.
There's that side of it, but I also think that obviously with the rise of like the DJ and producer kind of thing, there aren't as many grassroots bands as there used to be. There aren't the road warriors that go out and do the 2 month long van tour, as you know, not the way that they used to back in like the 90s and even like the early 2000s. I mean, that's you know, the first 8 years of my career was the exact same thing, you know, just get in a van and go. And
absolutely.
And you hope that you know, you made enough money to put gas in the tank and maybe you get 20 or 40 bucks in your pocket to go buy some McDonald's or something.
Yeah, that was the old days. And you're right, it's changed a lot. The education system, Full Sail and others, have changed things in such a way that people now go and study and learn how to do these things professionally and can enter the music industry at a much higher level than what we would call the entry level roadie coffee boy.
Yeah.
My Andrew Giffen is a perfect example. Andrew Giffen went to college, majored in theatrical lighting design and computer programming, and as a really young man came out working for some pretty big names like Steve Cohen and had the chops and the talent because of the education that he didn't have to take the road that you and I were describing before. That was much more of an 80s, 90s thing. You know, he's much younger than me, and he, you know, had the opportunity to do it differently, and he didn't have to suffer in the ways that we were talking about. Not that I would trade those days for anything.
Well, that's the thing, yeah.
There are a lot of different ways to do this now if you're committed.
I consider us actually very lucky in the sense that we did go through all of that, because you get a much greater appreciation for what you earned over, you know, like, not to say that nobody, you know, everybody earns it in their own right. But I think that the trial by fire method is certainly the most gratifying. I guess you have to be a masochist to some degree to say that, but like,
I mean, you know, I think everybody's method is the most gratifying to them. You and I did it that way. Somebody like Giff, for example, he gets his own gratification by learning and studying and getting the education. And actually, it's one of, you know, you and I both know that nobody does in life what they go to college for.
Sure.
Nobody. Yeah. He actually did. So, you know, I think he gets gratification in that way as well.
Oh, wow. So with that, like, you know, as Fish starts to get bigger, what changes did you experience as far as like, you know, obviously as the rigs get bigger, as the rooms get bigger, you went from being a bar band basically to being at the forefront of cutting edge technology in a pretty short period of time, I would say, right?
Yeah, and I had to take it upon myself actually to learn, because I could just tell you a story. And this is what was happening around me. We were, you know, four young men, the roadies, is me, Andrew Fishbeck, Pete Shaw, and Languedoc. And I was watching slowly but surely that once we started getting bigger, the person who was acting as tour accountant got replaced with a real tour accountant because he couldn't handle the way it was going. And the person who was mixing monitors in the bars got replaced by a real monitor mixer because we were starting to play real rooms. And I was watching people essentially, I guess you'd call it, get fired, replaced, and replaced. And that could have easily happened to me because it was technology time. And again, I was just like the rest of these guys. So I took it upon myself and went, I'm not going to let this happen to me. So I went and enrolled myself in classes in Dallas on Regal Row at Verilite, when Verilite was on Regal Row in Dallas. I went and enrolled in how to program an artisan class, how to repair threes, fives, sixes. The six had just come out, and just sent myself to school on my own and paid for this because I knew if I didn't keep up with the technology, I was going to get replaced too, because that's the way Fish was growing at such an exponential rate.
So I
took that upon myself and went and did that. And I think that move saved my career. And that was a long time ago, Greg. We're talking like 93.
Sure.
Something like that. And I just knew it, you know, so... No one told me to do it. I just went and did it.
Yeah, I mean, when you can recognize the situation that's in front of you, you have a choice to make. It's like you can either keep skating by and see what happens, or you can, you know, you can actually do something about it. And
yeah, because being the band's friend will only get you so far.
Yeah.
You don't have the talent to take it to the next level when it needs to go there.
Yep.
So, yeah. I remember my final exam programming the Artisan was they wanted me to program Emotional Rescue by the Rolling Stones. And they threw me in the studio with a bunch of like fake cardboard dummies and said, here, program this song. And I went and I programmed the song Emotional Rescue. And then it was literally like a final exam. And then I had to present it. And all these guys in suits and ties all piled into the studio, important people I didn't know, and I was like, whoa, who are all these people, like, what is going on? And they all like had their arms crossed and, you know, like no smiles, and show us your final exam. So I played it, and when it was done, the like head guy, I forget who it was, came up to me and goes, you know, we've seen a lot of these, and I'm pretty sure that's the best one we've ever seen. And I went, all right, I guess I'm doing something right. You know what I mean?
That's great.
So, yeah, that's a good story. And I think one of my favorite things about that, and you'll laugh, is the gobo wheel on a VL6 doesn't turn smoothly. It kind of clicks when you're going from gobo to gobo. So for the entire introduction of the song, I had it clicking to the beat of the drum beat of Emotional Rescue.
Oh, wow.
And I had it get right to the open hole right when the first verse started. And I think they loved that.
Well, that's always been one of your kind of signature things, I guess, is being able to plan out these different effects or looks or whatever that can stretch over any number of seconds or whatever, or over an entire section of music, and somehow magically, whatever it is that you're doing, it always hits exactly, like it always ends or clears or pops or whatever right at that perfect moment. And that's something
that's the result of a lighting designer who did not go to lighting design school and just made up his own style.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It happened to work out. Like, you know, instead, like, Why should it hit on the downbeat? Why should it start on the downbeat of one when it can stop on the downbeat of one?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's an interesting thing when you think about it, because I've been studying a lot of old concert films lately. I have this really crazy VHS collection all around me in this studio, and I've been buying a lot of tapes of old concert videos. And the one thing that is like very consistent through almost all of them is that exact device that you just spoke about, where it's like everything starts on something. It never ends on something.
Right.
And like, it's, you don't think about it necessarily until, you know, somebody like you talks about it and you're like, why not have something lead into it? And it gives it that much more impact when everything releases when you think it should start.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you what, that wasn't exactly a conscious decision that I'm going to do it this way. It was more like, this is how Phish's music works. They're the only medium that I have to work with right now. What's the best way to complement their music? And literally, that's how that style for me came to be. You know what I mean? If it was a different band than Phish that I started my lighting designer career with, I might have a completely different style than that. So
absolutely,
it's the universe all working together.
Yeah. When you were kind of developing your voice and everything, were there lighting designers that you looked up to? I mean, obviously the information, it wasn't accessible the way that it is now. Like, there wasn't a YouTube to just pull up, you know, concert videos and whatever.
I mean, everybody knows that back in those days, Candace Brightman was my hero.
And yeah,
a lot of my beginning style came from copycatting her.
Yeah.
You know, the big slow sweeps on the choruses and things like that. And then I just took that and developed my own style over time. But I used to love to go see Radiohead lighting.
Yeah,
I used
Andy's the best.
Go see Dire Straits lighting. I used to love to go see Yes back in the day. You know, and once I became a lighting designer, I wasn't going to see 90s Yes. I was remembering Yes concerts that I saw in 1980.
Sure.
And just remembering what they look like and going, oh, I should try to, you know, mimic some of that cool stuff. You know, I go to any show I go to, whether I like the lighting or not, I always see one thing that I think is excellent, no matter who or what it is.
Everybody has something to offer. I find when I go to concerts, I leave in the same sense where it's like, I always see one thing that I love, but I also see one thing that I do that I hate. And I go, don't ever do that again. Because I'll see somebody do that and I'll be like, I do that and it looks like shit. Yeah. Never do that again. And like,
yeah, I've had the same experiences, you know. Seeing other people's work, if I could choose one thing, one global statement that I've learned from seeing other people's work, no matter who they are, is I've learned to slow down.
Yep.
Like, I've gone, this is too busy, that's too busy. Oh, wait, I'm too busy.
Yeah.
What I do is too busy. I look at my own work, go, man, that's just, it's all over the map. You know? And so I don't know if that comes with age and wisdom and experience and just being open-minded about watching other people's work, like we're talking about. I've learned less is more.
Yep.
You know what?
Absolutely.
I mean?
So. And I think that is a, you know, I don't know if it's an age thing necessarily. I think it's a time thing. You know, it's just like, as you, because I think especially for you, right? So here's an interesting concept. You're in 2009, you kind of started over, you know?
Oh, 100%.
You know, 5.5 years off or whatever it was. And the technology had changed so much in that time.
Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, the energy.
The approach of even how to program and set up the console was completely different than any way we had done it before.
Yeah.
I didn't interrupt you.
No, yeah. But so like, I think, I don't want to say you were starting from square one, but in certain aspects you were. And so the excitement of it and the newness of it, you were kind of like a kid again almost, you know, in like those early days of 3.0 where it's like, all right, I got all these new toys. They do all these new crazy things. I got this brand new console, like so on and so forth. And so it was just like, let's go. Let's see what we can do with it. And so now you're in that 10-year mark and you can start to see it. Like even last night we were watching the dinner and the movie. And I got a funny little sidebar that I'll get to after this for that show. But I could see it where like probably right around that time, that 2015, 2016, you could start to see it, things started to relax a little bit more.
Yeah.
And like, and now, you know, it's much more apparent. But those first few years, and I know like, you know, there were some behind the scenes things that were working against you.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, two heads are better than one, and collaborating is, and it took me a long time to learn this lesson, that collaborating is a very, very good and positive thing.
Yep.
I mean, the band collaborates with people musically, everyone collaborates. And right around that time, I'm going to say 2015, I started collaborating begrudgingly at first, I'll admit, but I'm going to tell you that it's the single greatest thing I ever did, greatest decision I ever made to grow as a lighting designer. I started collaborating with Abigail Holmes. I don't know if you know who she is. She's done some, she did Talking Heads. She's done Roger Waters. She did
Ghost of the Forest, right?
Say that again.
She did Ghost of the Forest, right?
She did Ghost of the Forest. Yep. She was really... has a great way to think outside the box and to you know, to slow you down a little bit and teach you to let things breathe and the power of subtlety.
Yep.
And I started collaborating with her, and I've been collaborating with her ever since. And just the things I have learned from her, I can't even begin to describe. She's taught me so much. As a person, as well as a lighting designer, and to have somebody else's perspective and to have somebody listen to your ideas while you're listening to their ideas, she's a true collaborator. She doesn't just come in and say, all right, we're gonna do everything my way. She listens, I listen, we work together. And through working together, we've come up with some of the best things that have been going on in Phish as of late in the last 5 years.
Sure.
And it takes it. I'll be the first one to admit that I was a stubborn man to think, I don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
And that's a fool.
Yeah.
It's a fool who thinks that. And when I finally had that revelation and learned that lesson, my entire world opened up. Yep. So,
yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways. And I think, you know, especially when you're working for a band like Phish, the diversity of not only just like the style of music, but the diversity of approach, you know, from one day to the next. Today we're going to be a crazy rock band. Tomorrow we're going to be psychedelic spaced out thing, you know? And so like being able to visually represent the entire scope. If there's four of those guys on stage and they all are like a piece of the puzzle, it's only inherent that visually there should be more than one voice to some regard.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. 100%. I mean, the collaboration is creation, strategy, and implementation. And in the end, you know, I'm the one implementing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have all these tools at my fingertips. And depending on what mood, we'll call it, that the band is playing in on any given night, it's just figure it out and roll with it.
Yeah.
And absorb it. And don't try to force it. If you try to force it, it's not going to work.
Yeah. So, I'll call you out during set break.
Yes, you will. I know. But that's all just human emotion and human.
No, feeling. Of course. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's not, I don't know if the audience knows or not. Phish is not scripted.
Yeah.
There is no Q2 that comes after Q1. It's just, there's 700 possible things in front of you and pick the right one that's next and hope you're right.
You know what I mean? Yeah, so. Absolutely. It's an adventure and you got to buckle up and just go for the ride.
Yeah.
And it helps. It helps when you have GIF there to, you know, at the end of the day, just, you know, scream at if you need to, just to get that off, you know, just get things off your chest. And just like,
I try not to scream at GIF as much as I can. And, you know, speaking of collaborating, I mean, he's just as much a part of the collaboration, if not more than anybody else.
Sure.
I mean, GIF's mind and ideas and art is in that system as much as anybody else.
Sure. He manifests all of the abstract. He makes ideas become reality.
Well, here's what he's great at. You're correct about all that. He's great at me saying, I want to do this, and here's an idea, and here's a concept. And him saying, yeah, I like that. We can do that. And now I have an idea how to take that even further.
Yeah, sure.
That's his like specialty.
Yeah.
He'll take your idea and polish it in ways that you couldn't think of. Yep. You know?
Very cool. So so I wanted to talk about this. This is a funny little story. It's ironic that it happened last night. So that show that the dinner and a movie last night was the Dick's Thank You Show. Now, I don't believe that I saw you that night because I was a bit overwhelmed by the whole situation. But that was actually my 100th show.
Oh, wow.
And on top of that, the one song that I had been chasing for 100 shows was Harpua. So on my 100th show, I got my Harpua and they spelled thank you in the fucking set list. And it was a pretty amazing night to say the least. But yeah, like, you know, what changed, I guess, in, you know, in this 3.0 era where it's very obvious, like Fish has always been known for interacting with the audience. But there seems to be so much more intention behind it now in this new phase. Where it's like they are very much going out of their way to create these, you know, very unique experiences. And it, you know, it happens when you least expect it, or, you know, some things are planned. You know, the Dick's thing obviously went on for, you know, spelling shit in the set list, went on for, what, 5 years or so. You know, there's always the New Year's gag, and those have become so much more elaborate. Like, what is, you know... Are you involved? I know you're involved in the New Year's stuff, but like, are you involved in all of these different aspects of like, how are we going to play with the audience this year or this week? Or,
I mean, involved, it's an interesting question and it's hard to answer because oftentimes these ideas are spontaneous.
Sure.
The first time something was spelled out, it was spontaneous and, you know, it got planned in an hour,
yeah,
but it was a spontaneous thought. I mean, aside from the obvious, the fun things that they do on stage that are just spontaneous and fun, that might seem more planned out these days, like you're saying, you know, they just start as jokes.
Yeah.
If I happen to be in the dressing room when the joke, hey, what if we did this? Wouldn't that be funny? Ha, 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 hee, hee. You know, if I'm there, then I'm a part of it.
Yeah.
If I'm not there, you know, either getting caught by surprise or get a little nudge 5 minutes before and go, hey, we're going to do something funny tonight.
Yeah.
But I think you might be overreading into it. I would say that it's not as pre-planned out in 3.0 as you might think. I think they're just better at pulling it off.
Yeah.
Obviously there are some things that aren't planned.
Yeah, of course.
You're gonna spell thank you, you gotta think about that for a second.
Yeah.
And just how you're gonna do it.
Yeah, you know? And you gotta let the archivist know not to put Harpu in the set list more than once. It was so funny because I remember during the show him saying it and like, but we couldn't really make out, you know, when Trey talks, a lot of times you can't really make out what he's saying.
Right.
And I was like, what the fuck did he do? What? And then when we were watching it back and I was like, oh, and he's like, once the song appears, when the song Harpo appears, you only have to put it in once. It's very important.
Everything, it's funny. And just about everything that happens up there, it's those four guys.
Yeah.
There's not people whispering in their ears and saying, hey, what if you did this? Hey, what if you did that? This is just the culmination of 35, 6-plus years of them being together and knowing each other and coming up with ideas. And, you know, the funny thing about it is they're still having so much fun.
I mean, like, it seems like they're having more fun now than they used to. I mean,
to them, if it's not fun, they don't want to do it.
Sure.
So all those little fun things are fun to them. And they laugh about them, and they laugh about them before and after. And they laugh about them at dinner, and they laugh about them, you know, in the dressing room, and they're having fun. And that's, I think that's the key to everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not going to come up with fun ideas if you're not having fun in the first place.
So, you know, we kind of, I brought it up briefly. So like with the New Year's shows now, I don't know how much you want to go into, you know, the most recent one. but I will say this much, how ironic is it that Trey was social distancing before social distancing was a thing?
I guess I never really thought of it that way. All I can tell you is, I mean, we worked on that and worked on it and worked on it, and it was perfect, and everything worked however many times we went through it. And with the ironic part is that it decided to fail then.
Yeah.
After it. And you know, there we were some panicked people behind the scenes. We were worried, you know.
Sure.
And we had to keep getting reassured that he was safe up there by the safety people. And he, you know, there were people talking to us. There were people talking to him. There were people talking to the other band members. And, you know, just like in any production, you have some really professional, smart people keeping it together and keeping everybody safe. And the funny thing is, and I think you're going to agree with this, it was the most successful failure ever. I mean,
yeah.
Some people thought it was intentional. Some people thought it wasn't intentional. Some people thought it was great. Some people, everyone, and it went on and on and on. Social media kept, there were jokes flying, you know, there was the Lego rescue squad set, you know, you know, this is just my opinion, of course, and I'm not saying anything about it, but to me, it turned out to be one of the greatest things ever.
Yeah, I'm.
It goes to show you how Fish works.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. I mean, and like, it's kind of, you know, for those that really listen to the band and know, you know, the music that Fish creates, more often, and I don't want to say more often than not, because that's not fair, but like, very often, mistakes lead to the great moments in a show.
Well, of course. Absolutely.
And so that's kind of like the like bigger picture like metaphor for what Fish is like, well, we just botched this section or whatever, let's go out and make the next 10 minutes that much more special. And so
totally just hit the nail on the head.
I
think you've seen, other people have seen, I've seen Fish play a song and botch it, and Trey will just stop playing the song and go, we're just going to start this over again.
Yeah.
How many bands can pull that off?
You know? Oh, yeah, totally.
It's that. You know what I mean? And it's, and the fan base loves that, because the fan base, it's like family up there. They're that attached that you can make mistakes and we can all have laughs together and we can start songs over again. And there's no consequence to that because it's so loose and fun and free in our environment, where a pop star who screwed up a song, the audience would be flustered and the pop star would be flustered and the management would probably be flustered and someone would get a scolding because of it. And, you know, who knows what, but, it's such the opposite of that. And that's what makes it what it is.
Yeah, it's the full human experience, and it's, you know, especially in this day and age where so many artists are playing to a backing track, or they're this thing or they're that thing. Like, those guys are still just going up there and playing, you know, and warts and all, you know, you get the good, you got to take the good with the bad, and accepting that, you know, mistakes will be made is also accepting that these great things will happen. And
but it's,
you know,
it's like the bad is the good too. It's yeah. the good and the good.
Yeah.
There is no bad in a sense.
You sure. know what I mean? Sure.
So, you know, I think we're all, I can just speak for myself that I consider myself so lucky that it's still happening.
Yeah.
And I don't mean for my job or that kind of thing. I mean for the music and the experience,
the
and
spirit.
The fact that we're all still having that. We're blessed.
Yeah.
If that's your thing, we're blessed. You know, after the 5-year breakup, who knew what was going to happen? That yeah. when we broke up, for me, it was so sad. It was sad for all of us. And we were lucky that it came back around, and here we are again. I always, this is a crazy analogy, but I'm going to use it. Back when I was seeing hundreds of Dead shows in the 80s, they went on this trend for a few years where they were playing the song Day Job like every other night.
It's the worst song ever.
Day job. I saw a 2-night run where they encored with it both nights.
Oh, Jesus.
And it was like, oh, freaking Day Job. Hated it so bad. My analogy is this, and I'm talking about the real Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
My analogy is this. I would give my left nut to see one more Day Job.
Of course. Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Put that in the context of what we're talking about with Fish. We're all so lucky that it's happening,
yep.
you know, and there are people out there who don't like certain songs, and there's a lot of social media where people have their opinions that they say, and I stay out of it. But when I read that stuff, I always think to myself, you know, just be happy that it's
exactly,
still here.
Exactly. You know, and I say the same thing to a lot of my friends and stuff. And I'm like, you know, some of them, you know, their first shows were 3.0. And I'm like, you have no idea, like, what it was like, you know, like, even though I haven't been seeing, I never got to see them in the 90s. But like, you know, between the hiatus and then the breakup, and it's like, you know, we went a long time without ever getting to do it. And like, there were times where it was hard to watch. And now, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe you don't like all the new songs or this thing or that, whatever it may be, but like, just be fucking thankful that they're up there with smiles on their faces having a blast, because really that's all that matters.
That's yeah. exactly what I think.
Yeah.
That literally is all that matters. They could go yeah. up there and just play the same note for 3 hours and yeah. walk away, and that'd be amazing. You know? So, I'm serious. Yeah. You know,
play Time Turns Elastic 5 times in a row.
Fine, whatever. As far as the music goes, I have no opinion. I support whatever they want to play, whenever they want to play it,
yeah.
and it's all good by me. All
yeah,
of it.
Totally.
I like every song.
Yeah,
I like all of it. There's, if someone said to you, "What's the one song you don't like the most?" There isn't one. I like them all.
Yeah.
Been around long enough to
yeah to that's the thing is like you long, you know? you develop an attachment to all of it, because at the end of the day you're connected to every single piece of music that they perform, and so when you have that level of connection to the music, it's hard to be like, well, I hate this song, or oh, here we go again. Like, it's just you that doesn't cross your mind, because
never
you can't think that way, first off, like, because it'll show in what you're doing. I mean, I have the same relationship with Pretty Lights, where it's like, you know, sure, there are songs that I'm probably not going to listen to when I'm sitting in my office, but I'm not going to like outright be like, well, fuck this song, because like, if I have that thought in my head, then people are going to see it on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to. That's a really good point. And, you know, you have to emotionally attach yourself to every piece of music.
Oh.
And, you know, even if you're going to remain neutral about certain songs, it's still going to show in the way you present the visual that goes along with that song. If you don't care for that song, you have to, in my opinion, at least for me, I have to attach myself to every song in a positive way.
Yep.
And luckily for me, that's really easy to do with the band I work for.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, you, you hit the lottery on that one, my friend. So we'll shift gears a little bit here. You know, during, I guess you first started branching out during the hiatus, right? You toured with
the, I had to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, obviously. So let's talk about some of your favorite, we'll call them side projects.
I mean, a lot of them have a really special place in my heart. I've been known to say, and I'll say it again, that the Black Crowes saved my life, because after Fish broke up, I didn't have a job for 8 months and it was starting to become panic stations. And the Black Crowes called me up and hired me, and I toured with them for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and made some of the best friends I have to this day with that organization, and loved every minute of it. And it was a great experience. So there's that. Well, thank you, Black Crowes. And then, I had the honor
real quick.
And privilege to work for Justin Bieber for a year and a half. And say what you want about Justin Bieber, at the time, he was the biggest act in the world. And somehow I managed to partially play a role designing and running that show for a year and a half with GIF and a few other people. And Ariana Grande is another one, world tour caliber. These are just great experiences that I never thought I'd be able to be a part of.
Sure.
The Justin Bieber thing is interesting, because there were a lot of people out there when that was going down saying that there's no way the guy who works for the hippie band can possibly put together a pop show.
Sure.
And, I don't want to get into the details of it, but we did. And we put together a killer pop show. Yeah. It was, I'm really, really proud of it. And it was nice to be able to see that final product of work and, not say it out loud, but be able to say, I told you so, and the naysayers wrong, and show that there was diversity, that I was able to diversify if I had to, that I wasn't a one-trick
pony. Yeah. I used to get the same kind of thing, I feel like, where it's, when you're so attached to one thing for so long, it's hard to break out of that shell. So, like, I went and I did the 30 Seconds to Mars tour, and I did the Banks tour last year, and you start to, dip your toes in these other ponds, and you just hope that everything that you've learned can translate in these other places.
And learned. That's the key word, learned. I mean, I did a 6.5-month 20-truck R. Kelly tour in 2007 while Fish was still.
Was that the boxing ring tour?
Yeah, the boxing ring
tour. Yeah. Yep.
And I was just the assistant designer on that, and I was the lighting director. But I learned how to put together a hip-hop tour lighting-wise from Patrick Dearson, who was the lighting designer for that tour. And Patrick and I are friends, and he was looking for a lighting director, and my name came up, and he went, get him, you got to get Chris. He helped us with Fish and a couple of, so Patrick pulled me into R. Kelly, and I spent a month of rehearsals with him and a couple months on the road with him before he moved on to his next project. And I learned how to diversify, at least in the hip-hop world, which is similar to pop, from Patrick Dearson.
Yeah.
And I didn't forget what I learned. And when I got the opportunity to do it on my own without someone holding my hand, I remembered what I learned from my predecessors. And like you said, it's that knowledge. You remember what you learn and then just have the balls to move forward and give it a try for yourself.
Yep. So. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think too, so this is something that I wonder when you started doing these shows, and I'm assuming they were all time coded, right?
No, button press.
You were still button pressing for Justin Bieber?
And Ariana Grande. Yep. You know why? I'll tell you why.
Yeah, I'd like to hear this.
Ariana Grande was button pressed because we button pressed on Bieber.
Okay. Now,
Bieber had like 2,780 cues all on the go button.
Yeah.
With a little punt page on the side to add a little fluff. But that show was supposed to be time coded start to finish. And when we got to rehearsals, the time code was supposed to come from the keyboardist, somebody in the band.
Yeah.
Somehow the time code was coming from the band, and that's how it was all going to trigger. And they couldn't figure it out.
Really?
And we had like a month of rehearsals, and then it was 2 weeks of rehearsals, then it was 1 week of rehearsals. We were still writing the show. I mean,
holy,
the show
shit
was finally finished being written like just a couple days before. So once we were out for a couple of months, and maybe the time code got figured out, and at that point, I was pushing the button.
Yep.
You know, I knew it in my sleep. So we just left that button press for a year and a half.
That's crazy.
And then Ariana Grande, sort of the same thing, you know. And these shows change a little bit, so the time code kind of gets off after a while. And more than anything, you know, I got really good at the go button, and it was fun.
Yeah.
And it was fun to be able to go button and punt a little on the side, and it kept it from being just incredibly monotonous and boring.
Well, yeah.
Like, it, something to do, so.
Well, then that was the thing. So, you know, because I had always assumed, and obviously I know that this isn't the case, but like I had always assumed that you would just time code it and then send somebody out to babysit it and move on to the next thing. And
that's what it was supposed to be.
That's what
Justin was supposed to be. Ariana, we just decided to button press it.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's how it's done. The time code is how it's done. And I'm not, believe me, I wasn't trying to be some kind of rebel and going, it was supposed to be time code.
Sure.
It just
didn't work out. Yeah. I mean, that same, it's funny because the same exact thing happened with that Banks tour where like we had this whole grand plan to time code everything. And honestly, thank God we didn't, because like, so she plays to a backing track, but then there's live instruments on top of it. And they sent me like a mix of like studio versions and then some like rehearsal versions or whatever. For whatever reason, the like energy of the music just didn't translate to the recordings that I had. So we get into rehearsal, and we only have like 4 days of rehearsal before this tour. She had injured herself or something. The scheduling got all weird, so we only had like a handful of days of rehearsal. And they go to do the first like three songs, and my fucking hair was blown back. And I was like, what is this? I was like, this is not the music I just programmed to for the last 3 months. I was like, this is crazy. So like all the like minimalistic, like sexy, like really understated stuff that I was trying to go for seemed so inappropriate for like half the songs, because half of them took on this whole new life, this whole new bigness. Yeah. And I was like, well, back to the drawing board.
Yeah. It's painful when that happens.
Yeah.
Because you learn less to go, I need to hear what the live show sounds like.
Yeah.
Not just these album recordings.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So Justin plays, it's all tracked, right?
Yeah.
So we had the actual tracks. And of course, in the room, the energy is higher. But when we wrote that show, we had a much better sort of take on the opposite of what you're describing. It was pretty freaking close. But I can see how what you're saying is I can see how that can really grab you.
Yeah, I was just like,
get you down the wrong road.
Yeah,
and not even realize it.
Yeah. I had all these cue stacks, and I was like, well, I'm just going to import all of my Pretty Lights stuff, and I'm going to punt whatever doesn't work, and we'll just fix this as we go on.
Yeah.
It took me like 2 or 3 weeks to really kind of like recraft the show. And then by the end of like, you know, probably by within 3 or 4 weeks, because we were going hard. We were like, that tour was crazy. And there wasn't a lot of time to like update stuff throughout the day. But by like by like week three, I guess, I had kind of like recrafted the entire show and it made a lot more sense. But I was still same kind of thing, though. It was like 75% go button type stuff and then another like, you know, fluff here, you know, modify this thing here, whatever, blah, blah. But it's a lot more gratifying, I guess, when you can have these moments that you know are going to be the same every night. But then you can still kind of take a left turn when you need to.
Yeah, yeah. Both Justin Bieber and Ariana Grande had some of those moments where you could see the same moment 165 times. I think that Bieber toured 165 shows in a give or take. And you still get just as much pleasure from that 1 second moment that you did the first time, the last time.
Yeah.
I mean, some things are just timeless. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And you know, the more you move forward with those kind of things, the more you learn. I learned so much doing my first big pop tour that when I designed my second big pop tour, I knew the mistakes I had made the first time, and it made the second time that much smoother and easier, and you approach it with more confidence. You know.
Yeah.
I remember after doing the Bieber tour with the Ariana tour, constantly being in touch with the choreographer and going, "All right, I'm writing the lighting cues for this song. I need video of the dancer choreography so I can write these cues correctly."
Yeah.
Well, with Bieber, I never got any of that. And in the month of rehearsals, we'd watch the dance choreography and go, "Oh, we got to change all these cues. They're in the dark here. And then they walk down the thrust over there." And then we didn't, you know, like, it's not, we didn't get given the information and we didn't know we needed that kind of information.
Yeah.
So we got it all together in the month of rehearsals, of course, but second time around, next pop tour, okay, I need video of every dance routine. I need to see how they're moving, where they're going, where they end up, where's the sexy downbeat end of the song, what's the pose, you know, and once you start learning those things about those kind of productions, you can do it better and better and better as you move forward. So
absolutely. All right. Well, I think we'll wind down and we'll finish up with this last little bit. It's no secret that you are a massive sports fan.
This is true.
Go Giants. How are they going to do this year?
You know, I think the Giants are going to surprise a lot of people, to be honest with you. Or they could just be as terrible as they've been.
Spoken like a true Giants fan.
I mean, you know, I don't know. I always have high expectations.
Yeah.
But, you know, this year, and, you know, this is not something I really wanted to talk with you about today because it's all anybody ever talks about. But 2020, sports, no fans. What's that going to be like? Like, I, as much of a Giants fan as I am, I have no expectations at all for this football season.
Yeah, for sure.
Are we going to have a full season? I don't know. You know, I do a lot of work for pro basketball, pro hockey.
So, yeah.
And, I now work for pro football as well. I can't talk about that right now, but down the road, you'll hear more about it. And, you know, the lighting, in-game lighting for all those sports is fan-based. You know what I mean? And I really am looking forward to that getting normal again so I can go do that work because it's very different and it's a lot of fun. And like you said, being a huge sports fan and working in sports is like awesome. So, you know. Who's your football team?
Who's my football team? I've lost my love for football over the last, I don't know, ever since Peyton Manning retired, basically. He was my guy. So
Denver or just your guy?
Well, so my dad was a Colts fan, but he was a Baltimore Colts fan. He grew up in Jersey.
Yeah.
And he hated the Jets and he hated the Giants. So he was a Colts fan. So we kind of like, you know, when I was a kid, it was kind of like Colts and Eagles. I don't know. And and then when Peyton Manning got drafted to the Colts, I was like, yeah, we got the best quarterback ever. I'll be a Colts fan. And then I moved to Denver, and then he literally moved to Denver like a year later. And I was like, how fucking perfect is this?
My
favorite player just followed me to my city and then won us a Super Bowl. Like, this is
won a Super Bowl.
He's the greatest shit ever.
Yeah.
And then
and then they just kind of screwed it all up after he left, after he retired.
Yeah,
and then,
that's true. But I mean, you know, you can't just root for the winners.
Oh, I'm aware. But like, it was weird because like, so I had more loyalty to Peyton than I did to the Broncos.
Right.
Or the Colts after the way they treated him. And so, I mean, I'm much more, I'm a diehard basketball fan. I'm basketball number one, then football number two.
Got it.
And I'm a huge Sixers fan. Have been since I was a kid. I will be Sixers fan until the day I die. I wish they could get their shit together because that's, you know, very similar to the Giants. It's like every year they're going to be, this is our year. And then every year they find a way to screw it up.
Die hard New York Knicks fan in the 90s. Ewing, Larry Johnson,
sure.
Larry Johnson, John Stark,
Charles Oakley,
Allen Houston, like those teams. Yeah. Mace, you know, you remember Anthony Mason? Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, when it was Bulls Knicks, and the Bulls always had a way to beat us, yep. Even if it went to seven games, they always beat us in the end. But ever since that era of the Knicks, it's impossible to be a Knicks fan. They're just so bad.
Yeah,
I want them to win so bad, but to get back to that level of excitement that I used to have,
yeah.
You know, Patrick Ewing is probably my favorite basketball player ever. You know, it's just, you know. I get it. I know what you mean. Sixers, you know, Iverson, those were the
years. That was my dude, yeah. And same thing, like, you know, I'll give him props because he single-handedly beat the most one of the most unbeatable teams. I mean, that Lakers team that they went to the championship with, they went undefeated through the playoffs, except for that one loss that Iverson gave them. And it was basically just Iverson handed them that loss. So. So that was like, that was his gold ring right there, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, yeah, there you go. So it's funny. We love sports. We work for sports. We love music. We work for music. We all need to get back to work, man.
You
got to get back to work. You got to get back to work. I got to get back to work. All our friends got to get back to work.
That's right. And so that means wear a mask. Don't be a jerk. Take care of each other. Chris, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much.
Fun, dude.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. And
let's do it again soon. I don't know if your listeners want the same dude over and over again, but
I could talk to you. I could talk to you for 8 hours. What I could come up with a whole other batch of things we could discuss next time. I would love to do a part two.
All right, I'm in.
All right, brother. Till next time. Thank you.
Take care, man.
All right, cheers.
Bye.